I'm Alex Craner. I'm a former hedge fund manager and author. I published two books on investment management and commodities trading, and one geopolitical treatise about the relationship between Russia and the West called The Grand Deception, which was banned by Amazon in 2017. And I currently work as a founder and manager of Craner Analytics, and I also write on Zero Hedge, and I have a YouTube channel called Markets, Trends, and Profits, and I'm also present on Twitter as at Naked Hedgy. So there it is. That's me in a nutshell.
Yeah, I mean, I think anyone listening to a hedge fund manager, former one anyway, would be, I mean, aren't you a kind of dark elite, you know, of people who decide our fates in an unaccountable fashion? Or at least weren't you in the past, Alex?
No, not necessarily. I don't think every hedge fund manager is evil. You know, some people are just ordinary investment managers who, manage money for other people. And probably you have a small percentage of them that are plugged into these globalist networks and who have whose asset management side is a cover for other things. You know, people like George Soros and the like. But I think of the formerly existing 10 or 15,000 hedge funds, I would say probably 99% of those people are just like good faith investment managers. That's all.
But you're not in the inside loop, surely, and so you can't do the insider deals. You don't know where the investment is about to be successful and where it isn't. And surely, you know, it's only the ones who are on the inside that really make the big money.
Yeah, you're probably right about that. And in fact, empirically speaking, 95% of all hedge fund managers underperform long term. You know, they'll have a good year, a good few years, but longer term, 95% of them underperform. So yeah, it's a very small minority that have inside information and who can make money without the challenge of uncertainty of not knowing what's going to happen next in the world.
Now, I've asked you on this week to talk about the legacy at the week of the death of Mikhail Gorbachev, the Russian president. And I mean, it's a well, Soviet president, sorry. It was an enormous thing in the late 1980s, around about 1989, 1990, the fall of the Berlin Wall, Glasnost, the idea that this lockdown, Stalinist, Leninist, Trotskyist society was going to open up. I just wonder what you make of Gorbachev as an individual. You know, that progress from this enormous Soviet empire between the wars and into the Cold War, and then suddenly, no, we're not interested in having an empire. It's not often you see, I mean, I suppose actually the Brits did it after the Second World War, an empire just say, okay, we've had enough, and throw in the towel.
Well, I think that there was inevitability to it because in the starting from the late 70s, the Soviet Union was just sinking into a deeper and deeper economic crisis. Very similar, by the way, of to the crisis gripping the West today. Okay, everything, including zombie corporations, massive debt overhang. The central bank printing up money to cover bad debts and to keep the system afloat, and the whole thing just not working out in any way.
Yeah, but they're very different systems. I mean, that was a state-managed system, and this one, where at least, you know, you've got a kind of command economy. Nowadays, we're working on a market economy here in the West. So completely different systems, Alex.
No, not so much. You know, you've had it's a difference by degrees, because it's true that in the West you have private property and you have private enterprise, but the largest corporations are actually, for all intents and purposes, they're state-controlled zombies. You know, they may be in private ownership, But they still, something like, let's say, 20-22% of all listed companies in the United States, and the similar number applies for all Western economies, are zombies, meaning that they cannot pay their, they cannot even service the interest on their debt out of their free cash flows. So the only way that they can stay afloat is by central banks buying up their bonds, you know, indirectly, in some countries directly, in some countries indirectly, because in the United States it's illegal. But so what do? They buy their bonds through their trusted broker dealers. Basically, they're being kept afloat by central bank largesse, same as in the Soviet Union. And if they were left to free markets that we think we have, they would have, many of those zombie corporations would cease to exist. They would break apart, and some parts of it would go bankrupt, and other parts, maybe where you have some healthy productive capacities, would reform, reorganize and become different corporations. But because they are strategically important to the state, you know, things like General Electric, for example, and Lockheed Martin and so on, you know, they basically live from state largesse or central bank largesse. So in that sense, the system is exactly the same as in the Soviet Union, except there it was state controlled. And here it's less obvious, but it's definitely under the protection of the state and the central bank.
Isn't it maybe possible to say that the state is kind of in retreat, and you know, the financial institutions are starting to nudge their elbow their way into these forums of power, and it's now the financial institutions that are deciding which industries live and which die, which companies live and which die. I was just looking at Boeing recently because of their series of possible hacking software crashes of these nosedives of the 737 Maxes and related aircraft. And really, they're not viable as a company anymore, and yet they've been bailed out by the banks. So that is something, I suppose, that's been done in conjunction with the defense industry too, Boeing being a big defense contractor.
Yes, well, that's exactly it. You know, and so you have you mentioned Boeing. I mentioned General Electric. There are many. There's as I said, about 20-22% of all companies listed on the New York Stock Exchange are actually zombies in exactly that position. You know, you have big agriculture, you have big pharma is being profitable these days, but you have many industries that are strategically important to the state, and even though they're in private hands, they're not being allowed to go bankrupt because they constitute part of the, you know, they constitute the levers of control of the state over the society, and they also constitute their foreign policy levers of powers. So even though they are actually failing institutions in the sense that then they're no longer profitable, that they're no longer growing in terms of market share, they're no longer engines of innovation, they are being kept alive because they are strategically important. So it's no longer free market enterprise and open competition. It's the state protecting its own strategically important enterprises. And so in that sense, it is absolutely similar to the way things were in the Soviet Union. At the same time, you know, the small and medium-sized businesses are being destroyed across the board everywhere to make room for, you know, so for these large corporations, so that they do not compete, so that they do not compete for market share and for resources and for employment and so forth. So you really have a very robust process of Sovietization in the Western economy. And by now, I think that they're more similar to the way things were in the Soviet Union than they are different.
Okay. I mean, I interrupted you talking about Gorbachev, but how did he deal with this economic crisis then in Soviet Union?
Well, right. So, you know, by the time he came into power, which was, I think, 1984, 1985, I forget, it was very clear that the Soviet system would have to be reformed. Yeah. And so it was in 1985, starting from 1985, Gorbachev started a very gradual reforms, allowing for some limited private properties. He allowed constitution of private banks in the Soviet Union and so forth. But things were moving very, very slowly, and the crisis was getting worse. You know, I think that 1985, 1986, there was a little bit of increase in GDP growth, but then it went right back into recession. And so by 1990, there were already strong political pressures within the Communist Party, because there were more radical reformists led by Boris Yeltsin who were gaining a lot of political traction, backed by the West. And Yeltsin was pressuring for a 500-day plan of radical reforms. And he pressured Gorbachev to commission this 500-day plan from an economist called Grigory Yavlinsky. So the Yavlinsky formulated this 500-day plan, which, you know, once it was unveiled, it was calling for radical cuts in government expenditure, wholesale privatization of state enterprises, and the complete abolishment of price controls, right? So this was going to be extremely radical for a system that for 70 years functioned as a state-planned economy. And so basically Gorbachev was accepting this plan. And however, what he wanted to do is to do it gradually. And this plan was requiring very substantial funding from the West, so that the state would be able to, over a period of transition, that they would be able to pay, you know, state employees and pensions and their soldiers and so forth. But the West was not coming through with any kind of funding. You know, they wanted it to be radical, drastic, and no funding was offered whatsoever. Jeffrey Sachs, who participated in this whole transition thing, was saying that Soviet Union would need something like $15 billion in funding every year for something close to a decade. So very, very serious funding was being required from institutions like World Bank or IMF, but they were not offering any. And so Gorbachev got cold feet. He was like, no, we cannot do this. We're going to wreck everything and we're not going to have time to reform, you know. And so he withdrew his support from Yavlinsky plan. And by the way, the Yavlinsky plan had already been drawn up at, you know, Yavlinsky had been working on this plan before even he was commissioned to come up with it at Harvard, with people like David Lipton and Jeffrey Sachs and Graham Allison. And I think the Swede, Anders Arslund, was also involved in formulating that plan. And so basically Gorbachev got cold feet. He was like, no, we cannot do this. This is absolutely reckless. And he withdrew his support. And then in August of 1991, there was a communist coup, because they didn't want these reforms, so they wanted to take back control of their government. And then there was very rapidly a counter coup, after which, so by the reformists. So first the communists mounted a coup, which failed, and then the reformists mounted a counter coup. And then after the counter coup, Gorbachev was forced to resign. So he resigned as a general secretary of the Communist Party, effectively the country's prime minister. And then Yeltsin took over. And so in November of 1991, Yeltsin becomes the prime minister, and he gives himself the right to rule by decree. And by decree, meaning any decree, even if it is illegal within the Soviet constitution. And so that's when the big program of reform is launched, radical, you know, quote unquote, shock therapy transition. And that's when, you know, the Soviet Union starts to come apart, enters into the one of the greatest depressions recorded in the 20th century, definitely the longest lasting one, which was absolutely tragic for the Russian people. And so this is, you know, like people, many people in the West are aware that Vladimir Putin said that this transition was one of the greatest tragedies of the 20th century. But then, you know, the Western media interprets it as him being nostalgic for the Soviet Empire. And no, the fact is that this was a period when something like 60% of Soviet population fell into poverty. The GDP contracted something like 50%. It was worse than during World War II, when the Soviet Union was under intense invasion from Germany. Something like between 5 and 6 million Russian people died in excess of the normal demographic trends. So they had 5 to 6 million of in excess deaths.
So that sounds to me as if people are having trouble even feeding themselves, Alex.
Yes. There was widespread famine. There were outbreaks of preventable disease because the whole healthcare system imploded as well. And so it was a general social collapse. The economy collapsed. The society collapsed. It was horrible. I think that suicide became one of the leading causes of death for grown-up males. Organized crime, petty crime exploded. It was just a very, very dark period for Russia. And so that's kind of Mikhail Gorbachev's legacy. However, I do think that Mikhail Gorbachev was an earnest man. He was just very badly misled by his Western counterparts, you know. And I think that to an extent that's understandable, because the Soviet Union was in a very deep crisis to begin with. And at the very same time, you know, the West was in its heyday, you know, like the West seemed very successful, very prosperous and wealthy. And so, you know, from the point of view of a Soviet leader, it probably made sense to take advice from your Western counterparts, and particularly if you were dropping the whole communist ideology, which you know, it seemed that the divide between East and West was ideological, you know, that the West embraced capitalism, that the East embraced communism, and therefore if Russia became capitalist also, then in that case, we all now become friends. And so I think that Gorbachev expected that his Western counterparts would now be earnestly helping Russia to come out of the economic crisis, to reform its institutions and its economy, and to become a modern free market state.
Yeah, I mean, rather than entirely preying on the carcass of this organization coming in, selling off to the highest bidder the entire basically national infrastructure and manufacturing base.
Yes, exactly, except it wasn't even to the highest bidder. You know, it was, they manipulated the whole process so that there were no bidders. And so, you know, like Soviet, the remaining wealth, the enterprises and the resource riches of Russia were being taken with something like 99% discount to the book value. And then even lower than that, I mean, literally. So, you know, hundreds of billions of these enterprises were being traded for literally a penny on the dollar. And so, yeah, that was an organized pirate raid on Russia. But it was not, of course, you know, there were nobody in the West said like, hey, you know, like, why don't you open the gates and we'll come in and plunder everything. They said like, well, you know, when you need to reform your system and we know how and we're going to help you and we're all friends now and you can trust us. And so, you know, Soviet leaders did. And even Boris Yeltsin trusted, you know, I mean, not even, but Boris Yeltsin trusted them even more. He was ready to jump out of the airplane without a parachute because they told him so, and he did. So when he launched this shock therapy transition, that's in essence what he had done. You know, he just like took all the advice that was packaged up for him by Western advisors, principally, you know, a bunch of people from Harvard, and he implemented the program, and it was a complete disaster. But, you know, I think it wasn't like betrayal in the sense that they knew what they were doing. I think that they genuinely trusted their Western counterparts and went with their advice. So that was, I think that from Gorbachev's point of view, it was a mistake. It wasn't like a deliberate, it wasn't a deliberate harm to his country.
Well, maybe, you know, Yeltsin and Gorbachev were two dupes in different ways, where, you know, Yeltsin was more manipulable. You know, I look at our present leadership election going on here in Britain and see Rishi Sunak as a sort of a, who's a Goldman Sachs guy from the Treasury, as a kind of Gorbachev who kind of knows what's going on and he wants the best thing, but he's pretty much in the pocket of the globalists. And someone like Yeltsin, very much similar to Liz Truss, who will basically say whatever she's told to say, hasn't really got a mind of her own, or in Yeltsin's case, his own, and just borrows his ideas from other people. But trying to get into the soul of Mikhail Gorbachev, he was part of this David Rockefeller founded trilateral commission, which many of us who have studied Bilderberg have look at that as a sort of expansion of a successful 1950s and 1960s, even 1970s Bilderberg, and bringing together right-leaning elites around Europe to resist the Soviet Union. But this actually embraced people from that part of the world, from Japan. It was a much wider scope. It wasn't just the NATO countries. And of course, It was a group funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, initially anyway, that was steering towards globalism. So I suppose it's quite understandable that some Russians did see Gorbachev as really a traitor to his country, in that he was actually at heart a globalist.
Yeah, but I'm not sure that he knew. I'm not sure that he understood what he was getting in bed with. You know, and this, yeah, you're absolutely correct. This trilateral commission even goes back to before World War II. You know, it was during World War II. You know, it was called the three block world. You know, the plan was to, you know, this was a British Empire plan to organize the world and rule it as in three blocks. So yes, the Eastern Bloc, the Far East, ruled by together in alliance with Japan, the North Atlantic Alliance being ruled by the UK and the United States together, and then Central Europe under the German dominance. We have the same agenda afoot today. You know, the European Union is, you know, in not declared, but in effect is being set up to create Germany as a hegemon in the central and Eastern Europe. So I don't know that this agenda was well understood by the Soviet leaders at the time. You know, it may have been understood by some people in the KGB, but by then, you know, there were strong political pressures within the Soviet Union to reform the system, particularly after they got they went into the debacle in Afghanistan and got defeated. There was a heavy blow for the Soviet system, and so, you know, that was, I think, an acknowledgement that the West is prevailing, you know, that the West is prevailing and that the Soviet Union would have to be reformed. And I think that the problem was that they thought that, okay, so if we're going to drop this whole communist experiment and become a market economy and a modern, you know, capitalistic society, then, you know, it makes sense for us to cooperate with the Western institutions. And they needed a lot of funding from the West. You know, so for the Soviet Union and for Russia to transition from communism into a capitalist economy, they needed massive funding, and they thought that they would get it from the West. So obviously, this made it possible for, you know, institutions like the Rockefellers, Foundation, to seduce leaders like Mikhail Gorbachev and to say like, hey, we're your friends, we're going to help you, we have all this money that we could help you with, come join us, let's be friends, let's talk, sit at a table with us. And I think that from that point of view, probably, you know, it's, I think that Mikhail Gorbachev made all those overtures possible with earnest intent. You know, I didn't see any indication that he said like, oh, okay, so these are these evil people who want to take over the world and create a world government, and I think that sounds great and I'm going to join them because I want to be part of that. I don't think that's how it happened.
No, he was trying to maybe just save face, effectively seeing the Soviet Union economically imploding, crashing down. He wanted to make sure that not too many people suffered in that, and he's saying, well, look, if I give some autonomy to the Eastern European states and the Warsaw Pact countries, then when things go really, really badly wrong, they can't blame me anymore.
Well, yeah, that was part of it, definitely. But Mikhail Gorbachev was very keen on securing funding for the transition from the West. You know, he made many overtures towards the World Bank, towards the IMF, towards the European Union, United States, to try to secure the funding that they needed to transition the Soviet Union from communist economy to the capitalist one. And so this was one of his big priorities. And this is where I think that was his weakness. And that was how he ended up seduced into basically opening the floodgates and letting the West in. And
yeah, but he's died a sadder and a wiser man, hasn't he? Because quite a lot of what he's been saying more recently, although we've heard virtually none of it in the press in the West, has been very critical of the West over Ukraine, and saying, well, basically, back in 1989, when the Berlin Wall fell, we had all these assurances, these promises. They were all broken. And so he has been backing Putin in his operations in the Donbass, feeling betrayed by the NATO countries.
Well, yes, I think that he understood very, very quickly that he'd been played. You know, I think that probably the first slap in the face was the August coup, when he was forced to resign from power. He understood that he got played, and he even you know, in the early years of the Putin era, he actually credited Vladimir Putin with saving the country from collapse, because, you know, he said that the Russia was in the beginning stages of actual collapse, where it risked to actually fracture into several independent, Bantustans. And so he has been very supportive of Putin and very critical of the West. He understood that he'd been played, but, you know, until he understood it, he played along. The only thing I'm saying is that my belief is that he played along earnestly, not intentionally betraying his nation and harming it. That's, you know, that's the, you know, the the point I'm trying to make. You know, like I do accept that he's actually a very tragic figure in Russian history, but he was deceived. He wasn't. He didn't have ill intentions towards his country.
Yeah, he was kind of pushed into it, wasn't he, really? He didn't have a lot of choice, I mean, many people would say. And, of course, that's the way the international mafia love to operate. You, you know, say, well, you know, you we're giving you a choice here. Well, of course, you don't really have a choice at all. So what's your take then on, you know, the sort of in geopolitics today? Because there's some people pointing the finger at Russia and saying, well, actually, Russia is simply playing along with a lot of the geopolitics of the West, and for example with COVID, getting stuck into that, you know, as if they really believe in it. And many people look at Putin as just another game player on the international scene.
Yes, I've noticed that, and I find that people who say these things are generally sloppy thinking. It's a kind of a sloppy thinking, jumping to conclusions without really thinking them through. And there's a good deal of cynicism and smugness when such, you know, I find that people who express these opinions tend to just be like cynical. They dismiss any nuance to the actual events, and they just fall into this like, yeah, everything is crap, so, you know, like why even get excited about anything different? But, you know, I think it's absolutely not the case that Vladimir Putin is in the pocket of the Davos crowd, and that we are all just being played while they are arranging the world for a dystopian world government. And you know, it's, I have to say that I myself has been a little bit surprised by the way Russia has dealt with the pandemic measures, and the fact that they played along with this. I was actually genuinely perplexed. I couldn't understand, because, you know, if the government of Belarus understood that the whole situation was not what it was being presented as, and they didn't play along, then surely Russians were capable of understanding the same, right? However, I'll bring you back to 2020, and I'll remind you that Russia was the first country out with a vaccine against COVID-19, right? And that's hugely significant, and that explained to me exactly why the Russians were doing what they were doing. Namely, I think we can say this openly today, that the whole purpose of the vaccines was to usher in the system of conditional of health passes, right? To get everybody to carry a QR code or a chip or whatever as a compliance pass, right? And so the vaccines were going to be that instrument that would trigger the whole population to accept these passes as a way to get into, you know, into theaters, into shops, into restaurants, and to continue to comply with whatever requirements would evolve from out of that whole infrastructure.
Well, yeah, including into countries, you know. Some countries would bar themselves to people that haven't had however many is jabs to a disease which is long gone.
Exactly. And so this was going to be the instrument of total control. So, you know, like you would, wherever you go, you travel, you shop, whatever, and you're being logged and tracked. And so the pandemic was going to be the event that would trigger acceptance of this new system, of this new normal. And now here's the thing, because these people in the West, the Davos crowd, whatever, Bill Gates, they fully expected that their four or five vaccine manufacturers would have the monopoly on all vaccines, which would then mean that they would have the monopoly on how this system of freedom passes would be administrated. Because, you know, like you have a QR code on your phone, but you know, there's somewhere a whole infrastructure that where that code is read and that where all the conditionalities are being tracked and where, you know, you get a stop or go decision, right? So, somebody runs that whole infrastructure. Okay. And now if the Russians come out with their own vaccine and then they go and offer it to the whole of Global South, to any country that wants it for low price, and they even offer it under license for countries that they can, you know, like they give them the license to produce it themselves if they like. Now you can no longer have a monopoly on the administration of these freedom passes, right? Because now you have to, you know, if somebody is vaccinated with the Russian vaccine, then that would mean that, you know, these globalists would have to either accept Russia to participate in how this global control grid is operated and administered, or you would have to give up control over those countries. So this is why the Russians went along with the whole COVID pandemic agenda, because they saw it, they understood where it was going, and they were the first out with the vaccine. And then they said, here, we have a vaccine, people can get our vaccine. And now, you know, the organization that's being led by the World Health Organization and Bill Gates and the Davos crowd, now they no longer have the monopoly, and they can no longer force all of the 7 billion people in the world into their own control grid. Or, you know, they can do that, but then they have to include the Russians in how it's administered. The Russians have to have a say in how all this is administered. So, you know, like it's difficult to interpret these things, because it's really some kind of a four-dimensional chess that's being played. But, you know, to make the long story short, as I see it, there's no way that the Russians are cooperating with the Davos crowd to create the one world government. This is a true, genuine, and real alternative. And so I think that where we are today is perhaps one of the most significant events in the modern history, because, you know, we are literally on a turning point in history which changes the way the world has been run for the past 300 years. So we're going into something unknown, from a world that's been dominated by the West to a world that's probably going to be dominated by a multipolar coalition of governments and states. And we don't know what that's going to be like, but my own personal opinion is that it's going to be a whole lot better for the humanity.
Well, why do you say that?
Why do I say that? Well, because I think that the last 300 years have been extremely, extremely bad for humanity. I mean, you know, the West has colonized the third world. You know, we've wiped out five or six major indigenous civilizations. We've depopulated to the tune of 80, 90 or more percent most indigenous nations, you know, in South America, North America, Asia Pacific, you know, India and China have been turned from, you know, centuries old economic superpowers into actually a backwater. And then we've advanced from there to a century of almost total war. I mean, we are on a slow path to like Orwellian dystopia. So if we're going to change course from that progression, I say that that's a better thing. And even, you know, the the one world government would be a monopoly on power. So even on the premise that it's better to have choice than to have no choice, you're bound to have a better future.
Well, okay, looking at Ukraine, which is in our sights at the moment, I also see that the Russians have accused the Israelis of bringing newly emigrated Russians from Moscow who've arrived in Tel Aviv and been given Israeli passports. I mean, obviously, this is a pipeline which has been sort of chugging away since around about 1930, I think. The Russians are now in the process of closing down the center in Moscow where Jews register to move over to Israel. And also some of these are people have been fighting. These Israeli citizens have been fighting for Ukraine against Russia. So you can understand why the Russians are a little bit nervous about sending more Russians down to Israel to then be, you know, put on Israeli Defense Force uniforms or mercenary uniforms or whatever, and then head off to fight Russia in Ukraine. This is quite an important dynamic, Alex, isn't it? The relationship between Israel and Russia, which seems to be going downhill fast now.
Yeah, I do think that it's going downhill fast, but I, you know, to be quite honest, I don't know the detailed intricacies of that relationship. You know, I just see that there's a, you know, there's a genuine intent between Russia and China to put Iran, to create Iran as the regional power and the regional peacekeeper. And so I think that this is something that's making the Israelis nervous. And this is where I think the conflict between Russia and this is like a more important reason for the strain in the relations between Israel and Russia, I think, rather than these, you know, the dual citizen Russians being sent to Ukraine to fight against Russia, because I frankly don't think that they can turn the tide of this war. I don't think it's going to make a whole lot of difference, but I think for Israel, the strengthening of Iran as a regional power is a threat, or at least they perceive it as a threat. And I think that Russia is one of the powers that is helping Iran reach that stature. And so I think that the Israelis are very nervous about Russia and Israel and Russia and Iran strengthening their ties, and Russia actually helping Iran become a more powerful economically and politically and militarily in the region. I think that's the bigger problem for Israel.
Quite obviously, Ukraine is almost the apotheosis of what Gorbachev did in 1989-1990 in freeing these former Soviet states. Was this all kind of inevitable that this was going to come to a head somewhere, even if, you know, it wasn't in Ukraine, maybe somewhere else like Lithuania, Latvia, even Poland?
Potentially yes, because I see it's the continuity of the same policy of the empire, you know, which used to be the British Empire. Now it's more like an American empire, but it's always the same network of vested interests that is trying to create this one world dominance, you know, like one government dominating the whole world and running everything, you know, like a global empire. And the, you know, this empire already more than 100 years ago formulated their geopolitical imperative of securing the hegemony over the Eurasian landmass, right? And so to do that, they always have to make sure that a rival power cannot emerge, either Russia or China, right? And so over the last 200 years, you've seen again and again and again Western powers in one way or another, waging war against Russia. You know, you had the Crimean War in 1850s. You had the Napoleon invasion in 1812, right? You had the German invasion, the Operation Barbarossa, in 1940s, and now you have they set up Ukraine to be the bludgeon with which to destroy Russia. And so could they have used Poland? Yes, I think so. Baltic states maybe not so much, because they're weak. And I think that Ukraine was probably chosen because it is more important to deprive Russia from access to the warm seas, like the Black Sea and the Mediterranean, than it is to cut them off in the Baltics, you know. So I think that Ukraine would probably be the ideal bludgeon to use against Russia. But I think they're not going to stop with this. You know, they might set up Germany again. You know, like now Germany is going to, what did they announce? That they were going to double their military spending. I think it's entirely conceivable that over the coming years, they're going to start creating Germany again as some kind of a military power with which to try to confront Russia again. We've also seen the German economy has been under radical strains, and that the state is increasingly being the dominant player in the German economy. That more and more of the German GDP spending is the government rather than private enterprise. And now we see with these new energy costs, like a wholesale attack on small and medium-sized enterprises in Germany. So I wouldn't exclude that this is the beginning of a process of re-Nazification of Germany, which always includes plunging a nation deep into an economic crisis and then refunding development, but on the basis of military rearmament, you know, and military expenditure rather than private, private consumer enterprises.
Well, in 2014, Gorbachev brought out a memoir. I'm not sure if he's published other books since, but at the time, this was literally just after the Maidan coup in Ukraine. He was extremely despondent about that, saying that, you know, there must be proper negotiations. After that, of course, there were some negotiations which turned up with the Minsk agreement, which wasn't actually adhered to at all. And so, yeah, he's flagging up that we must have constructive dialogue between East and West, but it simply not happened at all.
No, because it is being actively sabotaged by those centers of powers that want a total war between East and West. You know, it was in April of this year that, you know, we just learned that, right, that there was a that the Russians and the Ukrainians have accepted like a tentative settlement where the Russians would go back to the demarcations from before February 23 of this year, right, from before they invaded Ukraine, and that Ukraine would promise to withdraw from the front lines, and that they would accept to become a neutral state and to accept that they would not become a member of the NATO. And then what did we see straight after that? Unannounced, all of a sudden, Boris Johnson flies into Kiev to meet urgently with Zelensky, and the negotiations are abruptly stopped, and we go back to full war. Right? Somebody obviously does not want cooperation; they want war, and so that's why we have war. But I think that this desire to wage total and continuous war is coming from the West, not from Russia. Because Russia, you know, like the Russians in December of last year, they made their demands explicit in two treaties. That one of them went to the NATO, one of them went to the United States, and they set their demands. They said, like, we need new security guarantees. We need Ukraine not to join NATO. We need Ukraine to be a neutral state. And the West said no. Right? This whole war could have been avoided if the Russians were giving given the appropriate security guarantees by the West. But the West said no. And so that's why we have that war. And I think that whoever is behind it, and I'll say in my opinion, the command and control hierarchy goes to the top of the international banking cartel. That's where the decisions originate. But I think that elite wants total war. They want destruction of Russia. They want to reassert dominance over the Eurasian landmass. And to do that, they cannot have rivals. So Russia and China have to be weakened and destroyed and regime changed. And nothing short of that will do. Right.
Well, it's fascinating you talking about the international bankers as being these kind of geopolitical strategists, and in fact, not just strategists, the people with their hands on the levers. Can you just explain how you think that works?
Well, I think that they're setting the agenda. They're setting the agenda, and their agenda is to dominate the Eurasian landmass because they are the ones who want the world empire. And here's why. Because, you know, the wealth of the bankers depends on them being able to keep stoking the credit cycle. You know, their wealth derives from them giving you loans and you paying back your loans with interest, because they give you, £100 and you have to pay 110 at the end of the year, or you have to, over the lifetime of a loan, you have to pretty much pay double or triple what you borrowed. So that's how, to make that happen, you have to work, right? You have to create wealth, you have to create value. And then a large chunk of that wealth that you created, you hand it over to the bankers in exchange for those loans that they gave you, which they conjured out of thin air. But, you know, the whole process doesn't work unless you have collateral, right? You have to have collateral, because otherwise the whole thing doesn't work. Otherwise, you're just printing paper that rapidly loses value. But, you know, in order for that value to retain value, in order for that paper to retain value, there has to be healthy collateral that's backing those loans, right? And so, you know, once you've saturated the credit cycle in your own country, then you go abroad and you start lending money on the basis of foreign collateral. And in order to be able to do that, you have to control those other nations, if not militarily, then at least politically and diplomatically. And in order to do that, you need to make sure that their local political processes don't prevent you from using their nation's resource wealth as your collateral, right? So the way you do this is you keep everybody divided and fighting each other, and you just extend loans to one side for rearmament, for economic development, for this or that, for corruption, and to the other side, you know, you lend money to everybody, and everybody is in debt to you. Everybody is using their own resource wealth to pay back your debts, right? And you're basically, in this way, you've created like a giant conveyor belt that transfers wealth from, you know, everywhere around the world where people created, and to you in the financialized form. And basically, if you can't control those foreign nations and those, you know, the regions politically or militarily, then it's Russian banks or it's Chinese banks that are going to use that resource wealth as collateral. So it's always, and in every case, that the geopolitical strategies are coming ultimately from the banking establishment. And we've seen even the rise of the Third Reich late 1920s and late 1930s. It was the banking establishment that kickstarted the German rearmament program. You know, you had first the Daus plan, and then you had the Young plan. The American bankers who basically flooded the German economy with loans, but those loans were to be used for heavy industries and for rearmament. And so in the late 1920s started the rearmament of Germany that went full on towards the World War II, not by mistake, but knowing that the Germany was being set up as as a power with which to destroy Russia and to assert control over the Central and Eastern Europe. It came from the bankers in that case as well.
Yeah, there seems to be this sort of Russophobic, it keeps coming back. We had 1812 Napoleon, we had 1941, we had Hitler, the breaking the Molotov-Ribbentrop pact. We've now got a similar sort of thing going on in Ukraine. But look, I've been following this economist Michael Hudson. I'm not sure if you follow him at all, Alex.
Yes, I do. I do.
Right, because what he's been saying, I think is a fairly devastating, if it's true. It'd be great to get your take, which is that at the heart of the conflict in Ukraine is this battle going on between the finance capitalists who believe that those with money should be able to buy up anything, including democratic institutions, the press, absolutely anything and everything. A kind of, I suppose, what you might call anarcho-capitalist way of doing things, and against the Russians and other people who are more interested in industrial capitalism, that is to say, where the state keeps firm control of the infrastructure and the regulation.
No, I tend to agree with that. I absolutely tend to agree with that. Look, if you just look at the progression of social development and economic development in the West, in Europe, and in the United States, you see that the finance capitalism is gaining greater and greater influence, and I mean, even like it's it, it, even academic studies are showing that the United States is no longer really a democracy, but an oligopoly, because the ostensibly democratically chosen representatives of the people still, most of the laws and measures that they pass benefit the top 1% or even less than 1%. So effectively, if you look at the system, what it does versus what we are told it's supposed to do, it really benefits the top of the hierarchy, which is always the banking system. And I think the same is clearly the case in Europe. And I entirely agree with Michael Hudson's take, and in fact, I think of him as one of the handful of economists that are actually worth reading.
Right. So we're a few years into Brexit now. Quite a lot of people here in Britain thinking, well, what was the point of that? It's almost as if Britain is being punished for Brexit. We've got horrific hikes in our energy prices, and this is all being blamed on Russia. Of course, it's really not the Russians' fault, but the Western NATO countries have just decided to impose sanctions on the Russians, and where we decide we don't want their oil anymore, we don't want their gas. What do you make of this so-called cost of living crisis? Because it seems we've now got a government here in Britain that feels unable to really do anything about the extraordinary hike in prices. And maybe you could say something about what you think is actually really behind those increase in prices, because in France, of course, the government has just simply regulated to make sure that the prices are kept to a minimum. That's not happening in Britain and Spain and many other countries.
Well, yeah, I think that the energy crisis is largely self-inflicted. You're right that in part it has to do with the draconian sanctions levied against Russia in the aftermath of its invasion of Ukraine. But let's not forget that this is following like the 2 decades of radical shifts from, using fossil fuels to transitioning to, wind and solar and other forms of so-called sustainable green renewable energy sources. And this has been again a planned, a centrally planned economic development, coming from the elites, like the people in Davos, who have decided for all of us what's best. and who decided that we should transition from fossil fuels towards these miraculous renewable energy sources, even though it's practically undoable. You know, that's some elite thinkers' chosen solution, rather than letting it to the free, letting the thing over to the free market. So, you know, in this year, this has created a very acute energy crisis. But I want to say something else, because we had this transition towards renewable energy sources, which means that they have defunded production, exploration, refining, and distribution of fossil fuel based energy forms in favor of wind and solar and these other kinds of things. And at the same time, sorry, I lost my train of thought for a second. At the same time, we had the war in Ukraine and sanctions against Russia. Fine. This goes a long way to explaining why we have this energy crisis. But I believe that there's also something deliberate going on, you know, a deliberate exacerbating of the crisis. Because I think that they still are intending to cause a large-scale destruction of small and medium-sized enterprises. And because you see that not just in England, but also in France, in Italy, in Greece, in Spain, you see that people are receiving electricity invoices that are 3, 4, 5 times what they were a year ago. So you have all these small and medium-sized businesses, also in Germany, who are saying, we cannot pay this. We're going to go bankrupt. We're going to shut down. And they are. So you have like a wave of bankruptcies of small and medium-sized businesses all over the place. And I think that this is part of the agenda of the Great Reset, you know, because they don't want all these small businesses functioning independently. They want to cull them and leave the space open for a handful of corporations that they run, you know. So I think part of the crisis is real, you know, energy transition and the war in Ukraine, but part of it is being created deliberately. And I just came randomly these days across, you know, there was a spat at the beginning of this week between Norway and other Scandinavian countries, because one of Norway's major power operators called Nordpool decided not to export electricity anymore. You know, at the time when prices were at their peak, highest ever. So that's hard to explain. But then it turned out that the chairman of this Nordpool operator in Norway was also the CEO of Euronext Exchange, right? And that the 3 out of 4 directors of Nordpool are also high-level officers of Euronext. So, you know, I'm not saying that there's collusion there, but if you wanted to collude, that would be a good way to go about it.
Well, who are Euronext?
Euronext is a major commodity exchange. It's a major commodities clearing mechanism in Europe. You know, you have commodities future, financial futures being traded on Euronext. That's where they're being settled.
This is what bothers me, is that we've now got things like our basic infrastructure, such as our ability to cook our poached egg on our gas cooker, is now part of some kind of casino, Alex.
Yes, exactly. And then you have the people who are managing all this with cross loyalties and put in position that they can collude with one another and pump up the prices beyond anything that's normal. Because, you know, like in a normal functioning open competitive market, when prices go up, you know, there will be people who will sell and take profit. So that'll put pressure on prices to come back down. And then you'll have people who will be on the wrong side of that market and who will take losses. And, you know, like normally you don't have these steep, almost vertical hockey stick price charts across the board, you know, like gas, electricity in France, in Germany, in Italy, in Spain, everywhere. You know, like this is very strange. And I, you know, like I'm not saying that there's collusion going on, but I'm saying that it might be, and it should definitely get investigated, because I think that there's all kinds of very, very nefarious stuff possibly going on.
You know, you, if you're on the inside, you can make billions, as people like Soros have done in the past, on these you know, sharp up and down, you know, movements on the graph.
Yes, exactly. And I, you know, like I really suspect that the part of the reason why this is being done and it is being allowed to happen is because there really is the plan to destroy the small and medium sized economy in the Western nations, you know, and leave it under control of the massive Soviet-style state-controlled enterprises.
I just wonder if you could round up by telling us, you know, how to follow your work, whereabouts to find your blog, and The Naked Hedgie, I think it is, isn't it?
Yeah, my blog is called The Naked Hedgie. I think the easiest way to find me is on Twitter, at Naked Hedgie. And then I also, for traders and investors, I have a website called iSystem Trend Following. And well, that's about that. You know, like I'd like to tell you about my books on Amazon, but I've been banned and canceled completely. So there are no books on Amazon anymore. I put the business title free of charge on my website, iSystem Trend Following. But my geopolitical treatise is only available from Red Pill Press. And so, yeah, I think easiest is at Naked Hedgie on Twitter.
And, you know, I've got to have a final question, which is, how do we fix it? What do you think? If you had the ear of the new prime minister here in Britain next week, probably won't be listening to you, but whoever they create as their new chancellor, let's hope it's not Nahid Zahawi, who's also the chair of the Pinay Circle, which is this far-right ex-intelligence people's group. I mean, he's probably going to be in the government. But if you had the ear of next week's new chancellor, or maybe, I suppose, it might be the same chancellor as we had before, Rishi Sunak, that is feasible, what would you be telling them to do?
Well, I agree with you that they will never listen to me, because they will listen to Klaus Schwab, first of all. Second of all, if by some magic they would listen to me, what you need to do is reform the monetary system. You have to do away with the fraudulent money being printed out of thin air and based on fractional reserve lending. You need sound money, honest money, because it's the monetary system that is causing all the trouble in the world, and which is contaminating practically every relationship in society, even family relationship. This experiment has lasted the last 300 years or so. Humanity has had other ways to organize economic activity and exchange without fraudulent money, and we have created major civilizations. Egyptians built the pyramids, and they never used money of any sort. We can do better than what we have. So you need to reform the money system. That's the crux of it.
And what do you put in its place then?
Yeah, I think you would want to use money, but I would, my best understanding is that there would have to be a dual system. You would have to have dual system of currencies, one that would be the national legal tender that would be used to pay taxes and fund state operations and defense and the police in a nation, but also have a dual the secondary monetary system that would let's say lubricate local exchange, so that people could locally use locally issued money to, you know, simply exchange for things they need, you know, food, fixing your car, paying your children's education, you know, like ordinary things that you do day to day, which shouldn't grind to a halt because some big bank failed. You know, like if some Royal Bank of Scotland failed, and suddenly there's a massive lack of liquidity on the market, that shouldn't lead your local baker and your local tailor into bankruptcy. So you need a local currency that can still lubricate these exchanges that people need to engage in order to, you know, offer what they have to others and also acquire what they need from others. That's a very simple economic exchange.
Yeah.
And economies don't suffer so much as the fact that the money goes away, right? Land still, you know, people still grow food, bakers still bake bread, you know, taxi drivers still can drive, and auto mechanics can fix cars. But the thing is that when everybody is stripped of their money, then nobody can exchange, right? So that's you need local units of exchange so that the local economy can continue to thrive, even if some big Lehman Brothers or Royal Bank of Scotland collapses, and then, you know, there's a liquidity crisis in the national market.
Yeah, but there doesn't seem to be any sign of that at the moment. So maybe we better just gen up on getting ready to do bartering and that sort of thing. Anyway, look, Alex Craner, thanks very much for joining us again.
Thank you very much for having me, Tony, and I look forward to joining you again in the future.